Hello, and welcome to Pitch Sequence, a podcast from the People's Baseball League, recorded in the historic 7th Ward of New Orleans, Louisiana. The train sound that you just heard was recorded live in New Orleans at the intersection of Poland and Royal Streets. I can't tell you what kind of train it is, but I do know the person that would know what kind of train it is, and that's Ben Hickey of the Rougarou, a pitcher. He's also a train enthusiast. He had a side hustle of selling toy train sets that he made into his main hustle. In today's episode, we're going to be exploring the relationship between trains and baseball, and in particular, Ben Hickey's relationship between the two. I do want to mention, in the background, you'll hear some jingling noises and the sound of a dog bone. That's my dog Ditto. I forgot to take his collar off, and he found a way to insert himself into the podcast. Can't blame them. Hope you enjoy. Ben Hickey of the Rougarou, who has been with the league for about 3 years. He wasn't there immediately at the origin, but soon after Ben Hickey joined the league. He's just been a staple of our league. And Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. So first question I want to start with is, what was your introduction to the game of baseball? How did you find out about baseball?
Well, my dad loves baseball. I got into it fairly late. My brother was actually playing Little League, and one day he asked me to play catch with him, and I wasn't really into it. I said, all right, I'll try it out. And he's like, oh, you got a good arm. You can't do anything else, but you can throw hard.
So what age are we talking about?
I think I was 13.
Really?
At the time. Huh. Yeah, I got into
that
it
late. That is late, for sure.
And then ever since I got really into it and came down to it, my brother got sick of me asking him to play catch with me. So it just sort of snowballed from there.
So you started when you were 13. Did you play in high school?
A little bit. I didn't get up a lot of playing time, though. I never pitched or anything. I used to go to baseball camps in the summer because I wanted to pitch really badly.
Yeah.
And
where was this? Where were you growing up?
This was in Maine. I'm from the central Maine area.
What city in Maine are you from?
Waterville. Yep.
Cool. Waterville, Maine.
Yep.
And what are we talking, like a classic kind of New England town with a Congregationalist church? Are we talking kind of industrial or?
It was an industrial type town back in its day, and now it's just Waterville.
Okay.
I don't miss it much, to be honest.
Oh, yeah.
You.
Okay. For those not from Portland, actually, it's been on my radar for a long time to go to Portland because I continuously meet people from Maine who I'm like, this is my kind of person, and if you, I want to go see where you're from. And I was fortunate enough to go there last April, but for those who are familiar and maybe not so familiar, how far is Waterville from Portland?
I think it's about an hour, depending on how fast you drive. Portland's one of the great Portland Sea Dogs, Red Sox AA affiliate.
Yes, I went to one of those games.
You went to one of those games, yes. And I tell you, you got to try one of their Sea Dog biscuits. Those are the greatest things.
I went to one of the games.
Do tell.
It was April in Portland, Maine, and it was cold as fuck.
Yep. Sounds like it.
And misty. So it was kind of a cold, wet situation. And but hardcore fans, they stuck around. They were like, they were there. And unfortunately, I did not get the Sea Dog biscuit.
Well, gives you a reason to go back, right?
Yes,
you saw the lighthouse, I hope.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, saw the lighthouse.
There you go.
Yeah. All right, so that's how you came to baseball. Tell us about your origin story to the People's Baseball League. How did you hear about it? How did this become part of your life?
Well, it really started out, I actually live in St. Rock, right across the street from a baseball field, and I was just hanging out outside, and I saw Christian from the Weebies out with a few guys practicing, like, and I asked him about it, like, are you guys a team? What's the deal? And he said, well, we just really just come out whenever we want, we practice. So I'm like, great, I'll grab my glove and I'll play around. And I did that for a while, and I guess I guess he got a message saying that the People's Baseball League was holding open tryouts, and I just remember hearing that, like, this is real. There's a real league that we can just get into. This is the greatest thing that ever happened. I feel like that could be the slogan of the league. I know I'm not the only one who's said that the People's Baseball League is the greatest thing that ever happened.
Wow. Oh, that's awesome to hear, man. So you heard about the league, but I'm kind of curious about like the gap between high school and how you're describing it, and then when you heard about that league, like, were you still into baseball? Were you kind of upset about it because you didn't get to pitch in high school, or like what was going on during that time?
I was pretty upset about high school, and I mean, I know I'm not the only one to say it was really political, and I was never going to be offered the opportunity to pitch. And
So was this public high school?
It was public, yeah. I don't know. I guess I just didn't have the right background. I don't know. I wasn't well thought of in there.
So it's just kind of like cliquish, extending to the baseball team?
It is political. A lot of parents are really competitive, and they do anything to put in. So eventually I actually stopped playing, which was bummed me out, but it's like, I could either sit on a bench and not play, knowing that I could, or I could just do something else, and I just stopped playing. But that doesn't mean I stopped practicing. My dad would still go out and throw baseballs to me, and we kept doing that for years. Just
what was his experience playing baseball?
Well, he actually he didn't play much in, I don't believe he played in high school, but he loved sports. He was a sports reporter for for a while.
In Waterville?
In Waterville, Maine, for the Morning Sentinel. And he comes from a big Red Sox family. My grandmother's actually one of the biggest Red Sox fans that I know of.
Oh, I love this.
So I guess they just inherited it.
Can you tell me a little bit about her Red Sox routine? How does this fit into her life? Is she on the radio, TV?
Like she watches most all the games on TV. She'll probably watch, I don't know, maybe 150 of them a year.
Amazing. Love that.
How much does her blood pressure rise when you say Bucky fucking Dent? Have you measured this?
That has not been mentioned, so I can't comment for my lifetime. But I think of all the championships that they've won now, I think she's pretty happy about that.
Just going back to where you started with the People's Baseball League, mm-hmm. and you were part of the draft, the initial draft.
Yes.
Wow. There's not that many people that are still around that can. I don't know. You were part of the. Do you know where you were picked? Like what round and what number? Do you want to know?
I think you called me and said I was drafted pretty early on because there was a lack of pitchers available.
Yeah.
But I still remember you calling me about that, and I remember being all excited.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast, the draft night.
Do you remember your signing bonus?
I was wondering where that went.
Well, and let's talk about this, too. Who, in the trajectory of the Rigaroo, who have been all the coaches?
Oh, coaches, we've had Andrew Ryan. We've had Matt Durham. Actually, Matt Durham's first. And now we've got Zach Simba. They've all been great. I enjoy playing for all of them.
So if you would compare each of them to a Red Sox manager in the past, who would you compare them to?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think a Red Sox manager is, I got to confess here that I got into watching the Red Sox in 2004. And I think... I know my dad was happy that I got into it, but I think he was a little bit upset, thinking my kids get into this, they win the first year. You know how many decades I suffered of all those near misses, and now you guys are fans. So.
Wow, I appreciate that, honestly. I mean, were you rooting for a baseball team before 2004?
No, I didn't.
Not even the Sea Dogs?
Hell, of course, Sea Dogs. gotta love the Sea Dogs. They were actually the Marlins affiliate when I first started watching them.
Wow, what a connection to New Orleans.
Yeah, that's right. Saw their AA team, and then their AAA team.
One time, I saw a Portland Sea Dogs game on TV when we were living in New Hampshire. And the one time that I saw a Portland Sea Dogs game, later LSU quarterback Josh Booty was playing for them. So, you know, you were just talking about the Marlins-New Orleans connection. There's a Baton Rouge connection also. So,
I went there for the hat giveaway.
Oh.
And the hat, originally they were a turquoise color.
Yep, that's the
Sea Dogs. They originally, because that was the Marlins influence. Yeah. So the splash of the Caribbean through the Marlins system had arrived in Portland, Maine.
Yes.
In this turquoise fashion. And so that was part of their uniforms for like several years, and then now they're traditional like Red Sox colors. But the night that I was in Portland during my spring break, last April 2019, was the 25th anniversary hat giveaway where they went back to the turquoise hat color, and that was part of the reason why I ventured out into the 50 degree, windy, misty, cold weather, and I got that hat. Fucking got that.
All right, yeah. So, just in case there's anyone listening here who was thinking maybe there is some part of Adam Cronenberg that is not a nerd, he left New Orleans for spring break to go to Portland, Maine. To you heard about all this this partying that he did there. So, I think it's been laid to rest. There's no part of Adam that is not nerdy.
Get into the theme of this episode, which is trains and baseball. What is the relationship between trains and baseball? And what I can tell you right now, specifically in the relationship between trains and baseball, is that Parlow Brewery, which is next to a train track in the Bywater, a train goes by frequently, four or five times a day, has also provided a couple beers for us. Eric, what's one of the name of the beers?
Trains Across the Sea.
Trains Across the Sea. And believe it or not, we've already consumed that, and we have another crawler called
Across Train. The tracks.
Oh, that's also great. That was Across the finished the one. Excuse me.
Hobo Knuckleball.
Cover your tracks. Cover your tracks. So that is what is fueling a lot of this episode this evening, and also that Ben has a. Particular relationship to trains. So, Ben, let's start with that. What was your first, how would you describe your relationship to trains?
Oh, it's hard to remember how I got started with all that. I think just like everyone else when you're young, you like trains, and just like with baseball, just kept snowballing, and I got into model railroading, and managed to turn it into a business, and it's just kept going. Ever since.
So you said it's a business, so
yeah it started about that a little bit. It started as a hobby. I used to go to model railroad shows, and I realized you get some really good deals, so I would try to buy a few pieces to resell. So I'm like, okay, I can fund my hobby and keep building my layout. So I started doing that, and then kept going with it. Like, you know, I could probably turn this into a halfway decent business. And
was there anyone in your family that introduced you to trains, or how were you initially introduced to
it? That's the funny thing. Not really. I just I like trains, I like cars, and I guess I didn't need an influence to get into it. It was just something I was going to do no matter what.
Sort of like it found you.
It found me, yeah.
Yeah.
So model rail, I'm fascinated by model railroading. I'm fascinated by like the world building aspect of it. If you want to talk about that, and then the other aspect of that is that the stereotype is of a certain kind of like just very nostalgic kind of worldview as far as the world building.
Right.
And do you think that is something that's universal, or are there people who use it as a kind of canvas to explore other kind of world building sensibilities?
Well, I think just like of any other creative outlet, you can build whatever you want. I think with model railroading, the real thing is to build it as realistic, make it as realistic as possible. I think. But you can build whatever you want to create. You can. I know I built my own baseball field.
Nice.
In HO or one
within the train tracks.
I built it as a diorama so I could move it around. So if I ever decided to build a new layout down here, I could just drop it in. Move them around that way.
Is it based on a particular park, or?
It's not really based on anything. I just wanted to make a vintage-style baseball field. I know I went to school for graphic design. I learned how to make decals, so I made up a bunch of vintage signage, and I put the decals on small pieces of sheet metal, cut them all out, and there you'd have a miniature sign for the outfield of your outfield of your field, and just kept building. And
so, is it actual like kind of historical companies, or are you making them up? As well?
No, they're all. I think everything on there is realistic. I've got old car ads. I've got ads for ice cream. Just anything that looks cool, I put it out there.
I'm just curious, like, what is, like, there's a lot of trains that come through New Orleans, and are there any trains in particular that when they go by, you're, like, kind of catch your attention?
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm always looking to say, what's coming through today? Because every once in a while, you'll see something out of the ordinary. You might see railroads. Sometimes they lease them out, so sometimes you'll see a locomotive operating here that belongs to another railroad, so that's pretty cool. I know once a year there's a steam locomotive that's out in Metairie, and every year they do a Christmas train with it. From my house I can actually hear the whistle of it, and it's distinct because you can hear the whistle of the steamship going by, but once a year you can hear the train whistle, which is pretty cool.
Have you been to any baseball fields, minor leagues, or professional that incorporate a train that like you approve of?
Because
I have a couple in mind that I will I'm going to mention, but I'm just curious how you feel.
I'm trying to think of all the fields I've been to. I guess I haven't been to that many, surprisingly.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of railroad-themed minor league teams, especially out there.
Yeah, the two that I can think of, one professional, the Houston Astros.
Yes.
They got the Minute Maid Park. When they score, there's a train that goes across.
Yeah.
And it's pretty fucking awesome.
Yeah.
You got the conductor, and he's like, it's a cool scene. I like it. I like Minute Maid Park. A fan of my fan experience there.
I was tempted to take a road trip out there last fall to see them play the Red Sox.
Yeah.
I was really tempted to go out there. Should have done it.
Book it. Yeah, that's. I don't know if that's going to happen again. Well, no, they're American League. That'll happen again.
It could.
And so the other one, though, was my favorite minor league ballpark. I went on a minor league baseball tour through the Appalachians. And sort of through the theme of like seeing small town America through these baseball fields and beyond. and Montgomery Biscuits. They have built their stadium in like an old train depot.
Wow.
And it is fucking awesome. It just, and it's also like a bowl, and it just, the space itself, you look at it and you're like, yeah, it totally makes sense that there's a baseball field here. And in the outfield, there's still a functioning railroad, and it's totally possible to hit a home run and hit a moving train. As
yeah, who knows where your home run ball is gonna end up.
Yeah.
I think there's an old story of Ted Williams. He hit a home run, it landed in a boxcar, and the ball ended up traveling 1,000 miles. I can't remember nice. Where exactly it ended up, but it's a pretty cool story.
Of the People's Baseball League, and we're going to start talking about the history of trains in baseball beyond New Orleans and just the general sense of trains and their relationship to baseball. So, Mike, please take it over.
All right, so the first thing that occurred to me, this is before, so I did some research for this because it was kind of hard to find the resources even online for this question. I think there's a book waiting to be written about this. But the first thing that occurred to me was this is the 150th anniversary. This year is the 150th anniversary of the first professional baseball team, the Cincinnati Red Stockings. And it's also the 150th anniversary of the laying of the Golden Spike in Promontory, Utah, for the Transcontinental Railroad. Now, that's totally a coincidence. There's no connection between those two. But from that point forward, I would argue that the development of baseball and the development of the railroads in their importance to American culture in different, very different ways, but just their importance to American culture just grew at an accelerated pace over the next few decades. And so that was the first thing that occurred to me. And then I just did some research on how railroads were important to specifically professional baseball in the intervening years, and a lot of this what I got comes from a Sports Illustrated article called "Railroad Crossing: Look Out for the Stars" from April 8th, 1991. That was by Jack Cavanaugh. So the thinking in terms of professional baseball teams and how they traveled at that time. So this is mostly along the Eastern Seaboard. And you figure cities like New York, Philadelphia, Boston, St. Louis had at least two, sometimes three professional teams at the same time, an American League and a National League team. New York had the Yankees, the Dodgers, and the Giants simultaneously. And so compared to today, we're talking about relatively short distances that the railroad was really ideal for.
Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, New York.
Exactly. St. Louis was the most western and the most southern city. You know, Chicago, Detroit, these were kind of far-flung outposts of the time.
Cleveland.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So the usual configuration was that clubs would charter two sleeping cars and a dining car, which would be attached to a passenger train that was already moving between, you know, Boston and St. Louis or what have you. And so they would be attached to that train, and the players would have access to the rest of the train if they so chose. So Babe Ruth was known for traveling through the passenger's cars and just, you know, talking to people. Back in the 1930s, the St. Louis Cardinals, at the time it was the Gas House Gang, Dizzy and Daffy Dean, Joe Medwick. There were members of the Cardinals team, players as well as kind of like trainers, just other personnel, who had a country music band called the Mudcats. Of the players, Pepper Martin was the most prominent, and he played harmonica for the Mudcats. And they would go back into the passenger train cars, and just entertain the people who were there.
Wow. Or, as if baseball during the day was not enough entertainment.
Right.
Carried on through the night.
So, and in addition to Pepper Martin, there was also an outfielder named Stanley Bordizzari. His nickname was Friendly. All the Gas House Gang had nicknames. You know, Ducky Medwick and Dizzy and Daffy Dean, Red Shandiest. So Bordizzari played something that he had created himself that combined a washboard, a car horn, and a whistle. So
very New Orleans.
And it was like a 5 or 6 piece country music band. Wow. That they would walk through the passenger train entertaining people in between the major league cities at the time. So what's also interesting is that the train cars would often do double duty as spring training hotels.
Wow.
So they'd be in Florida or other southern states doing spring training, and overnight they'd sleep in the sleeping car that was at the railroad station.
Wow.
So another colorful anecdote from this article happened during Yankees 1925 spring training trip when they were in Shreveport, Louisiana. So when they were set to leave, Babe Ruth started running through the train just through the middle aisle, followed by a woman with a knife.
What?
This is 1925, Babe Ruth.
Wow.
Shreveport Railroad Station.
Amazing.
He runs all the way to the back and jumps off the observation platform and waits for the woman with the knife to get off the train, and then he catches it as it's leaving the station. So just this very dramatic exit.
What?
I don't think you're going to see that at your Major League Baseball city airport.
Wow. This city might.
So I'm going to ask both of you, to your knowledge, the current baseball scene that's going on, are there any train rides that are going on from one game to the next? I feel like there's a little bit.
The Eastern Seaboard teams still use Amtrak occasionally.
Wow.
Really?
And both teams used it in the 2009 World Series between the Yankees and the Phillies.
Wow.
So I think the Eastern Seaboard is the one spot in the U.S. that still has the infrastructure to be able to get between the cities quickly.
Yeah.
And I think that's just the crucial
I'll tell you one thing. Riding on a train is way more comfortable than flying. Even
yes,
I mean,
you're grounded. You're on the ground.
Yeah.
Like so, just someone who gets a little bit of anxiety on a flight, which I feel like is increasing recent. But also, if someone who feels some anxiety on a flight,
yeah,
you know, a train. Thank you, Ditto, for ruining the sound. I'm just kidding. I love you, Ditto. No, a train is much more preferable than taking a flight.
It's very civilized, I think.
It is. I heard that even sleeping while the train's in motion, people say it's great because you rock back and forth as you go along. And it is way more comfortable. I went on a steam excursion this summer in Chattanooga, and I got to ride in one of the restored coaches, and the seats in it, it's like riding around in a recliner. And I'm like, what happened between the 1920s and 2019?
Yes.
What
wow,
happened?
Dude, I want to know that. I want to.
Well, I think
I got to tell you something. Territory. Mike, I feel like you have a few more questions for Ben.
So I'm still the model to come back to the model railroading.
Mm-hmm.
I just am fascinated about the possibilities of that, and I was wondering if you could tell us about if you had unlimited resources to create your ultimate world building scenario, what would it consist of?
Yeah, what would that look like?
Oh man, I could do whatever I want. That probably have a warehouse full of trains. I'd go with the larger scale. If I could do whatever I want, I'd probably try and incorporate the trains with my radio control vehicles. I think that would be a cool way to go about it.
And
you on the field with that when you have the radio control. But yeah, but let's get back to this, like the ultimate. Like what's your fantasy of what this train world could look like?
And try to keep it family friendly.
There's endless possibilities. A part of my approach, though, with model railroading and just whenever you're trying to create something, it's really just I don't plan a whole lot of it out. I usually dive into it, and I sort of let the materials sort of suggest ideas as to what to build. Like, I'll start working on one thing and say, oh, you know what would go really well with this be to create, like, with the baseball fit. All right, let me back up to you. I started making the miniature signs. I'm like, what could I do with all these signs? I'll build a baseball field. So it's just stuff like that. You start working on one thing and say, oh, well, I want to create this now. And before you know it, you've got 10 projects going at once. And with no end in sight.
Mm-hmm. So you think your ultimate would start off the same way as something small scale?
Probably. If you did like a large scale, you could also, I know one thing that would be cool to do is you start with a large scale, but you can build a model railroad within it with N scale, which is a really small train. So you can have, they call it a garden rail, which is G scale, but you can make the N scale can be a miniature garden rail size train. In a G-scale world, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
I got a few more questions for you. Do you have any mentors in the game of model trains that, like, you follow that have been really inspirational for you?
Yes, I've had quite a few. I used to be in a model railroad club back home, and hang out with those guys. They're all older, and you know, they had some experience, and they pointed a few things.
This is in Waterville, Maine?
Well, I was in the central Maine area, but within an hour drive.
Yeah.
One gentleman from my that club, he had what I'd call the, probably had the best layout I've ever seen. It's just in the basement of his house. But he was just, everything was detailed. You know, he'd build a, you know, structure, but then he'd just keep decking it out with details galore. And that really inspired me to do it. And he eventually switched scales. He went from HO narrow gauge to what's called ON30. I know no one listening to this has heard of that.
Did that cause a big stir?
No. I mean, it was just personal layout.
Did any marriages break up because of that?
No. He was good. But I did buy one of his HO structures and put it in my layout. So that was cool.
But what was the structure?
It was a miniature fire station, and that he had done. He had painted it, and I hit a little Dalmatian on it and everything. So I thought it. Tradition of that. I'm gonna add some more stuff to it. So I put an emergency helicopter on the roof, and I added a few more things. Put I put a few more fire trucks inside of it. Adding to it.
So I would think. I mean, you probably had to have like a whole bond issue for the town for that, huh? Yeah. I mean, that's that kind of infrastructure.
Oh, I know. Yeah, there was some money moving around in my town, kind of like Louisiana.
Yeah, nothing short of that.
So even the model railroading world, we can't get away from political corruption.
Exactly.
That's one of the lessons we're going to draw today.
Well, Ben, I just want to thank you for coming on the show. I feel like you have a fascinating story. You're a first player profile. You're one of the first. You are the first person that we have
that's awesome.
Interviewed. And so I want to thank you for coming on and answering our questions. And I guess my final question to you is, like, what's your dream for the People's Baseball League? Like, what's a dream scenario in the People's Baseball League for you?
I've actually thought about that quite a bit. My dream is to get everyone in the league to go travel around and go barnstorming, playing
nice.
Other teams from
yes.
other cities. I know we've talked about it in the past, and I know it takes a lot of work to coordinate all that, but I've got my fingers crossed, and I'm willing to travel anywhere.
Traveling by train?
By train, car, whatever. Train would be ideal.
Train would definitely be ideal. I do want to mention that your... your current coach drives a Mazda MPV minivan.
Yes.
And he is, for 2 years in a row, back-to-back winners of best driver of a minivan.
That's right.
And I feel like that should be part of this barnstorming.
It should be. We might need to take a team effort to clear it out to get more than one person in there.
Mike, you got any more questions for Mr. Ben?
And that concludes the second episode of Pitch Sequence, a podcast from the People's Baseball League. A few shout-outs for today's episode. Thanks again to our guest, Ben Hickey, my co-host, Mike Parker, Eric for delivering the beers, Eric Lind and Eric Jensen for making the beer at Parlo. Thank you to both of you for everything you've contributed to this episode. I also want to give some credit to some of the train sounds that you heard. So the first one was a live recording. We also heard from Sounds of Steam Locomotives, number 2, Stack Music Sampler, or Makeup of a Train, edited and recorded by Vinton White. And that comes off of Science Series, Folkways Records, and Service Corp, New York. Yeah, we're getting deep here. We also have Fast Freight on the Nickel Plate. The Sounds of Trains in Motion. And these were contributed by Mike Parker. And believe it or not, there's 3 other ones I didn't get to. There's 5 records that Mike Parker delivered to me to listen over. I did not get to all 5. I got to 2 of them. 6? Hold on. 3, 4, 5, 6,
seven records. So Mike Parker, thanks a lot for all these records. I'm going to get to some more listening right now, and I'll let you listen out. Let's finish off with Steam Railroading Under Thundering Skies.